up, and well, maybe later. Thank you.
There were a few people came up to me during the break and said I should be a little nicer. At all. In fact, I believe very strongly that Dr. Morris does an enormous service to science, and I really mean that, because he is the sort of person that always has to be around for science. He is the maverick. He is someone who is questioning established ideas, and it is always good to question established ideas. I think we refresh ourselves in our assumptions by trying to go back and see if what we look at has any base, and therefore I'm very happy to have him around, and I'm honored to be on the same stage with the foremost creationist scientist in the United States, and I'm having a wonderful time. Now, what I wanted to talk about was the statements he made about the age of the universe, that there are certain assumptions made in distances. Could you turn the slide projector back on and give me the second slide in the first carousel? It's a tough one now. Oh, sorry, third slide, first carousel. So you may not know, but I'm going to keep going till 3 in the morning. I have 4 carousels with me. There it is. Okay, there's that light as galaxy. That's 12 billion light years away. Now, Dr. Morris mentioned, he's absolutely right, that we do not measure the distance of that galaxy directly. That's true. I agree with it. There are only certain distances that we can measure by parallax. And parallax is the fact that when we look at a star, we go back and forth on a baseline, and we can measure slight changes in distance. We go to one side of the orbit in the Earth, and we take a picture of a star. We wait 6 months, and we go to the other side of the orbit, and we take another picture. And we can measure how much that star has moved in its position, in the same way that if I wanted to estimate the position to someone in the third row, I could take a look at him. I could walk over 10 feet and take another look over there. And by the angular change, I could estimate how far away he was. Now, that only works out to relatively short distances, perhaps 300 or 400 light years. Within that distance, there turns out to be a large number of stars. And we uncover in that distance a relatively simple relationship, and that is that the average brightness of the stars is related to their distance. And therefore, we begin to imply distance beyond that as the stars get dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. Now, for example, this galaxy, which is said to be 12 billion light years away, is implied by in being at that distance by, first of all, identifying that it is indeed a galaxy, not a single source of radiation, but many. In other words, it contains perhaps hundreds of millions of stars. The way that we infer the distance, once it's identified as a galaxy, and that identification is easy to make, is that it is very, very faint. Now, Dr. Morris said this was an assumption, that if it's faint, it must be far away. That's an assumption. I agree. All astronomers will agree. But if you don't accept the assumption, you have certain consequences. For example, it is possible, and no astronomer will argue with this, that galaxy may not be 12 billion light years away. That's possible. In fact, it could be 10,000 light years away. And the reason it seems that way is because the galaxy is very, very small and very, very dim despite its close proximity. That's perfectly possible. It's true with all the other galaxies. However, it's a little bit like standing out on a street and watching the telephone poles in the distance and say, you see how they get real small when you get far away? I says, yeah. Well, that doesn't mean they're far away. It just means that down there are little bitty telephone poles. So if you go down there, you can pick one of those guys up and put it in your pocket and bring it back. Now, the neat thing about this galaxy, because it is the most distant galaxy ever discovered, that if the space shuttle ever gets off the ground, all we'll need to bring it back in is the cargo bay of the shuttle, because it ought to be so small that we can bring it home and hang it up in the middle of the auditorium and watch the little bitty stars go around. That's the kind of assumption that's involved. And I intend no disrespect to Dr. Morris at all, but I simply want to say what the assumption is, and if the assumption isn't valid, then we can do everything that I just said. Now, he said, for example, the radiometric dating, that we're not sure which process to use, and so forth. They have many assumptions, and you don't know what the proportion of the daughter elements was when you started, and so forth. Well, in the rubidium-strontium method, you don't assume any of that. You measure it. You can measure the proportion of the daughter elements. You can determine if the system has been closed, and so forth, and so on. Now, what he's talked about is a phenomenon which is very well understood by geologists called inherited age. If a mineral exists near a volcano. When the volcano goes off, when Mount St. Helens explodes, the rocks on the mountains, probably many of which were formed a long time ago, can often get blown out with the exploding volcano and get laid down with the strata. Now, all the strata, all that ash around Mount St. Helens was formed exactly 1 year ago. But the rocks, which have been lying on the surface of Mount St. Helens at least since its last eruption 100 years ago, and possibly longer than that, those rocks were clearly formed before last year. And in many cases, they will get laid down by planification without being disturbed. That means if somebody comes around a billion years from now and picks out that, it is unfortunate enough to pick out that particular rock, he might tend to say that this particular rock in the Mount St. Helens deposition was in fact laid down much longer ago than it actually was. And that is an error that you can make. It's true. It's real. There are lots of papers about it. That's why he can quote them, and geologists worry about it all the time. However, does it say a single thing about the absolute age of the Earth being in error? The answer to that is no. It means that when you're near volcanic areas, and that's the only place these things occur, when you're near volcanic areas, or when you're near areas where whole rocks are being washed out by very violent floods and then resedimented without the rocks ever being disturbed, ever being broken up, geologists can recognize that kind of formation. You have to worry about picking up those whole rocks because they might give you ages, not where they are now, but where they used to be. Does this have any influence on the age of the Earth? No. Okay. Now, one of the things that I found very interesting about Dr. Morris is that he mentioned that there were other processes that we could date the Earth by. I think the Institute for Creation Research has a pamphlet, and they got 78 or 85, a whole bunch of processes. You can make these measurements the way he showed on his colored slide, and you can tell how old something is by the processes, and for some horrible bias, those nasty evolutionists, they only like the processes that give us old ages. And there are lots of processes that give us young ages, and they don't accept them because they're prejudiced against them. Well, this is the debate, and we're going to bring the scientific facts out tonight. And what I would challenge Dr. Morris to do in his remaining 5 minutes is to tell us what those processes are that yield a young age for the Earth. If there's real scientific evidence, if there's another process which is equally as valid as the radiometric dating, please tell us what it is. We'll get a chance to discuss it out in the open. And failing that, I simply have to say, if you know, you say there's a process and you won't tell us what it is, there must be something the matter with it, and I'll leave that simply at that point. Okay. Let's see. This is what happens when you're ready to go to 3 in the morning and bring too damn many slides. Could you show us on the first carousel? This is embarrassing. Let's see. Slide 48. Got that? I hope you understand the reason I have all these slides is because I have heard tapes of Dr. Morris' debate, and he is really good, and I simply wanted to make sure that I had things to fall back on. Now, one of the things that Dr. Morris may point out is that there's quote after quote, and he read a lot of them at the beginning when he opened, of scientists saying that, gee, we ought to re-examine evolutionary theory. Evolution doesn't fit the facts. Evolution is untestable, and so forth and so on. Well, all the quotes are real. He didn't make any of them up. He's an honorable man. He doesn't fake quotes. But I want to show you what the quotes come from and what they mean. Now, up here, I've tried to show you the semantic trick that is being played in using many of these quotes. Now, we use the word evolution in a couple of ways. On the left-hand side is what I call the evidence of evolution, the fact that the Earth is old and the fact, and it is a fact, that when we dig down in the ground, we find a succession of forms. We find a record of change through time. 50 million years ago, what was alive on this planet, and we know a lot about it. The museums of the world are packed with fossils all over the place. There's so many fossils that the guys can tell you where they are, and they can let you go ahead and dig, and you still can't get them all out. The museums of the world are packed with evidence of change. 50 million years ago, life was different from what it is today. 50 million before that, it was different again, and so forth and so on. There was a record of change through time, and the record shows overwhelmingly and with great eloquence that the past changed, or evolved, if you prefer, changed into the present. Okay, given those facts, how do we explain the process? The process is real. How do we explain it? Well, there are two general ways which biologists have tried to explain it by. One of them was started by Charles Darwin, and today we call it Darwinian theory, neo-Darwinian theory. gradualistic evolution, or the combination of mutation and natural selection. This is the classic model. It predicts slow and gradual change and so forth and so on. There's another model you may have heard about. It's championed by Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard and Niles Eldridge of the American Museum of Natural History in New York. They coined a mouthful of a term called punctuated equilibrium. I don't think it's ever going to be as catchy as Darwin's theory. Punctuated equilibrium suggests that evolution is saltatory. It jumps, and we see rapid changes followed by speciation and another rapid change and so forth and so on. Now, there is very great controversy here. The fact of the matter is that Dr. Morris has produced a large number of quotes from the punctuated equilibrium people saying that neo-Darwinian theory is not adequate, Darwin's theory is not adequate, so forth and so on. My own, and I'm not an evolutionary biologist, I'm a cell biologist. I do biochemistry and molecular biology. I don't work in evolution as a professional. My own feeling and my own reading of the field is that I'm on the side of the punctuated people because I think their theory is closer to the facts, and I think we're on the verge of uncovering the genetic mechanisms of how it works. However, we don't know the mechanisms, and we don't have a satisfactory theory. Now, Dr. Morris may think that this is very important when he says that no theory of evolution formulated at the present time can explain all the facts. That's true. I'll say it if he doesn't say it first. If a theory existed which explained everything in the scientific sense, there'd be nothing for evolutionary biologists to do. I mean, they could sell insurance, they could be deans, no offense, Dr. Rohr, or something like that, but they wouldn't have to be evolutionary biologists. If you look closely at the nature of other sciences, you will discover that we have no atomic theory which explains all the facts, no gravitational theory which explains all the facts, no theory which accounts, for example, for the unitary nature of the charge on the electron. Now, is this a disaster? Does this mean all these sciences are in disrepute the way Dr. Morris would like to have us believe evolution is? Of course not. This mystery is precisely what draws men and women to science. Einstein said, in an off-quoting passage, that the most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and science. And that's perfect. No one can say that better. Now, Dr. Morris can produce quote after quote showing that no evolutionary theory is adequate. And if he runs out of them, I'll give him five more. But can he produce a single quote that says that the evidence is upside down, that the fossil record doesn't matter? Can he produce a single quote which says we see no record of change in the past? Can he produce a single quote which says, in short, that evolution has not occurred? Of course not. And the reason he can't do it is because that is what the evidence says, that evolution has occurred. Okay. Can I have slide 58? This is daring. I want you to understand that. I wouldn't normally do this. Same carousel. Okay. It's daring because I'm going to talk about human evolution. There's a rule when you debate a creationist. Don't bring human evolution up, because people might not mind how a fern got here, they might not mind how a trilobite got here, but they're certainly going to mind how they got there. And therefore, human evolution is touchy. When you get right down to it, there's only one reason that people get emotional about evolution, and that's because we put ourselves into that biological world, and we say that our species was produced also by the evolutionary process. Now, I will not deal with all the specimens that have been on Earth, because there are simply too many. I've tried to establish that there is an extraordinary close relationship between our species and, for example, the chimpanzee and also the gorilla and also the orangutan. Now, the relationship is so close that if you were to uncover two species, let's say, of Drosophila, which had, as we do with the chimpanzees, 99% of the sequence homology in non-repetitive DNA, and that's a big mouthful, which means the important genes in the genetic material match 99% of the time between us and the chimpanzee. If you uncovered two species of fruit fly in which the homology was that close, you would suggest the possibility of a fertile offspring between those two species of fly. Now, I'm not going to suggest the possibility of a fertile offspring between us and chimpanzees, and I'm certainly not going to suggest that we do the experiment. But the fact of the matter is that the relationship is extremely close. Okay, what do we find out about the development of our own species? I mean, did we develop from monkeys and so forth and so on? One of the things that is not understood, not appreciated, I think, by most people, is that we know that we are recent appearances on this planet. Well, surprised, so is the gorilla, so is the chimpanzee, so is the orangutan. They, if anything, are the offshoots of an evolutionary tree, and they, in effect, are offshoots of the same tree that produced us. Now, the fact of the matter is we didn't come from them. Absolutely, we didn't evolve from the apes we see today. No way. We don't find them in the fossil record. We evolved rather from a common ancestor, the sort of splitting that we see consistently in evolutionary tree. Okay. Now, for example, let's go back, because there are enormous gaps before this, and Dr. Morris will point them out, and I'll say, yes, they're there, to about 3 million years ago. At 3 million years ago, there's a series of creatures with different species names, but all of whom are given the genus name Australopithecus. There's one. There's a skull. An Australopithecus skull. Now, there was enormous controversy as to whether or not Australopithecus was manlike. And I'm sure Dr. Morris, when he gets up, he's going to have a lot of quotes both ways. But here's where it gets interesting. You see, Australopithecus has a lot of human-like characteristics. The teeth look a lot like ours and other things. It looks sort of, you know, intermediate between a man and a monkey. You wouldn't know how to classify it. The sort of problem you get if you have good transitional forms. Now, until very recently, it was debated and hotly debated whether or not Australopithecus walked upright. The reason for that is all we had were skulls. It's really hard to tell from a skull whether something walked upright. There's a slight difference in the foramen magnum, which is the big hole base of the skull. And if you walk like this, then it's tilted back a little bit so you can hold your head up straight. If you walk up straight, the foramen magnum is in a slightly different position. In very few of these skulls is it well developed. And he may have quotes from the Leakeys and from other people saying, Australopithecus walked on its knuckles like a monkey and so forth and so on. Just listen carefully to the dates of the quotes. Next slide. We now have much more recent skeletal remains of Australopithecus. This is a nearly complete skeleton. It's given the nickname Lucy. That's what this particular one is, from a young female. It dates about 3 million years old. And in Lucy, we have part of the pelvis, as you can see. Now, she was part of a find that was made, which include a large number of other individuals, including, as shown in the next slide, a nearly complete pelvis. And that is shown for comparison to a human pelvis. There is, since these finds, no doubt in any anatomist who can take a look at that hip that Lucy walked upright. And that is the clearest way to see it is by looking at the entire hip bone. She walked upright, and so did all her friends, which we found in this simple Australopithecus find. Okay. Now, later than Australopithecus, we find, as we move from 3 million years to the present, creatures who are more and more like ourselves. For example, there's something called Homo erectus, who lived about 1 million years ago. We give us the same genus name as ourselves, but a different species name. We have many skulls of the Homo erectus type. We also have a more primitive type called Homo habilis. And these, of course, lead to another species, which you've all heard about now, called Homo sapiens neanderthalensis, and to our own species, which we, in an arrogant burst of pride, call Homo sapiens sapiens, which means man, wise, wise. And that is a misnomer if I've ever heard one. Okay. Now, Dr. Morris will look at the array of these creatures. And he'll say, well, all we have in here are either apes with big brains or people who had malnourished, they had rickets and they have little brains and so forth and so on. And indeed, it is true that there is enormous confusion among students of human evolution to say how we should order these specimens and how we should draw the family tree. Next slide. No two anthropologists do it the same way. Here are two proposed evolutionary trees coming from Australopithecus and leading to our own species. They branch in different places. They're not sure where they came from and so forth and so on. Dr. Morris has probably got a quote from one guy saying, this one can't be our ancestor. He's probably got a quote from another guy saying, the other one can't be our ancestor too. So we don't have any ancestors. The reason for that, essentially, is not because, I repeat, it is not because we lack transitional forms between ourselves and these creatures. It is rather because we have an embarrassing abundance of transitional forms, so many we don't know how to connect them. The next slide is a graphic representation of sort of how to show this. Dr. Morris will say, and a special creationist would believe, that there should be a clear gap in the fossil record between fossil men and fossil apes and nothing in between. This is a series showing the size in cubic centimeters of the inner casts of hominid brains leading from Australopithecus near the top to Homo erectus at the bottom. And what they show in terms of brain capacity is a continuous series of intermediates. Please look at this. Show me the gap. Show me the clear dividing line between one and another. What Dr. Morris or any other special creationist will be left to do is to get up and look at this beautifully clean transition and say, that's a monkey, that's a monkey, that's a monkey, whoop, that's a man, that's a man, that's a man, so forth and so on. You just can't do it. The evidence doesn't lead you to do it that way. It simply doesn't work. This slide does not purport to show that the one on top was the great-great-great-great-grandfather, and the next one was an offspring, and the next one, and so forth. This slide is not arranged in supposed order of descent or anything else. It is simply designed to illustrate the fact that we have all sorts of things between ourselves and things that are recognizable in terms of being another species, namely something that is not around today, but if it was around, we might call it an ape or something like that. This is not what one would predict if man were separate and specially created. It rather is what one would predict if what we see in the universe, in the world, is, as I believe, not as a scientist but in a religious sense, part of an enormous unitary creation in which the Creator has not made us separate but has welded us in to the fabric of life which encompasses all the organisms on this planet. Thanks.
Gentlemen, we'll now proceed to ask the speakers to give their concluding statements. Again, by common agreement, new information or arguments are not to be introduced. These are to be summary statements. In fairness to Dr. Morris, who lost a minute or two in his opening statement owing to the failure of the microphones, and in fairness generally, if he wants to overrun the five-minute time allowed for the concluding statement, that will be perfectly correct.
That's a dangerous offer to make, but I'll try to not abuse it too much. Since Dr. Miller did challenge me to produce some of the evidence for a young Earth, I guess that's not introducing new material, so may I have them, I think, about two slides beyond what we were. This is the table that he mentioned. This is one of our publications. Obviously, there's not going to be time enough to discuss any of them. No, beyond that. Way beyond that. There, that one. These are some of the processes which, with the same assumptions as a normal radiometric dating, that is, of a constant rate, a closed system, and assumed initial boundary conditions, you can get all sorts of different ages. First one, the decay of the Earth's magnetic field, is probably pretty good because the assumption of a closed system with the core of the Earth being involved, where the magnetic field is generated, is probably pretty good. Assumption of a constant rate, pretty good. Half-life, about 1,400 years, because there's nothing much going to change it at that point. Now, this was worked out in detail by Dr. Tom Barnes, whom I mentioned earlier, who learned his physics here at Brown University. But for many years, he's been a leading researcher in the field of atmospheric physics and magnetism, has a couple of widely used textbooks in this field. He knows what he's talking about, and he's presented this material before many scientific bodies and teachers and so on, and there's no real answer to it except to just say that the assumptions are wrong. And they may be, but with the reasonable assumptions, even more reasonable than in the case of radiometric dating, you'll get that the age of the Earth from that is on the order of 10,000 years. And so with the others, we don't have time to discuss them. The next slide shows some more. Next slide. And the next slide. And the next two more. Each one of these we could discuss and show that the assumptions are reasonable, that all the possible sources of error that have been at all capable of being allowed for have been provided. The dates that they give, we would suggest, are at least as reasonable as those given by uranium or rubidium or potassium dating. But in the last analysis, you can't know for sure, of course. We would just suggest this, that since the assumptions of uniformitarianism are more likely to be valid for a short time than for a long time, those processes that give young ages are more likely to be correct than those that give old ages, other things being equal, and besides, there are many more of them. So the weight of the scientific evidence is that the Earth is young. That's the testimony of the geological evidence, too, formed by one catastrophe, primarily hydraulic in nature, as we've already pointed out. Another point that was made by Dr. Miller was that man and the chimpanzee are closely related because of the biochemistry, the hemoglobin, and so on. And that does seem to be the case as far as the alignment of the tabular values. My colleague, Dr. Parker, who is chairman of our biology department, once an evolutionist, used to teach evolution in college, has become a creationist, and I can't vouch for this, but let me just quote what he says on this. He says, if you look at blood serum studies, that is the right anus serum, sure enough, man's closest relative is a chimpanzee. But on the basis of milk chemistry, man's nearest relative is the jackass. On the basis of cholesterol level, his nearest relative is the garter snake. On foot structure, it's the glacial bear. On the tear enzyme, it's a chicken. And on the basis of blood antigen A, And the basis of blood antigen A, our nearest relative, is the butter bean. So it depends on which chemical you use as to what the family tree turns out to be. Now, with respect to human evolution, I'm sorry there's not really time. Dr. Miller has already said several times what I would say in response to what he said. So, to an extent, he's right, and I don't have time to do it. But with respect particularly to the Australopithecines, now these were at the bottom of both of the family trees he represented. They're the ones that he spoke of that relate to Lucy, to Homo habilis, and so forth. Now, there is a difference of opinion as to whether they walked upright or not. And the people that have made the greatest amount of study of the Australopithecine fossils, and I'm speaking of Lord Zuckerman in England and his team, including Dr. Charles Oxnard, who now in this country is dean of the graduate school and a professor of anatomy at the University of Southern California. These men are primarily those who have analyzed this material in detail, measured it in the laboratory, not people who dig it up in the field like Dr. Leakey and Dr. Johansson and others, but have devoted a great deal of time to detailed multivariate statistical analysis. And they've taken all the Australopithecine dentition, the skull structure that has been found, the limb bones, the knee bones, and so forth, and they have come to the conclusion that although if you orient the structure in a certain direction, it looks like it might be an erect posture. If you turn it around 90 degrees, it looks like an ape, the four-legged posture. As Dr. Leakey once said, Australopithecus was a long-armed, short-legged knuckle walker. I think he somewhat changed his views since then, but the evidence is still very equivocal. Dr. Charles Oxnard, who certainly knows this subject far better than I do, surely, but he knows it as well as anyone, I think, he says, as far as the Australopithecine fossils are concerned, these new investigations suggest that the fossil fragments are usually uniquely different from any living form. When they do have similarities with living species, they're often is not reminiscent of the orangutan. And he's convinced that they're a blind alley, whatever they were. They're some kind of an extinct ape, more closely allied with the orangutan than anything else. And Dr. Zuckerman, who surely knows this subject if anyone does, in his book Beyond the Ivory Tower, says this: in the interpretation of man's fossil history, whether the faithful anything is possible, the ardent believer is sometimes able to believe several contradictory things at the same time. He says, if man evolved from some ape-like creature, he did so without leaving any fossil traces of the steps of the transformation. Now, there obviously are different voices on this subject among anthropologists and others. And at any rate, the evidence is still very equivocal with respect to human evolution and the intermediate forms there. And this is the so-called most recent arrival on the evolutionary timescale. And if we don't have any clear evidence of man's origin, then no wonder we find such a complete universality of gaps in the other layers of the fossil record. As far as the evidence goes, each basic kind of creature was created that kind of creature. There's variations within the kind. Whatever the kind was, it could perhaps be as much as the family, say the horse family, the dog family, and so on, or the dog genus. Could be genus, could be family, probably broader than the species. But at any rate, beyond a certain limit, there is, for example, Dr. Simpson says, each of the 32 orders of mammals appears suddenly in the fossil record without any known antecedents, and so on. Now, this is exactly what you'd expect in terms of creation. Now, we have not proved, and I said that from the beginning, that we cannot prove creation scientifically, we cannot disprove evolution, and you can put it just exactly opposite. These are models, they're paradigms, they're systems, they're beliefs. What we can do, however, is continually look at the evidence in terms of the two models. That's what we've tried to do tonight. And you may have your convictions one way or the other, and that's fine. At least we suggest that the current method of teaching only the one model needs to be changed. We need to have not only this kind of a meeting, say, once every decade in a big auditorium, but every day in the classroom as an exercise, continually having the students look at both models as they relate to all kinds of evidence, recognizing that there are two worldviews and both deserve consideration. Thank you very much.
Lord hath delivered him into my hands. Slide 69, please. Careful. I'm getting myself in trouble. Now, Dr. Morris has committed an enormous logical contradiction with his 79 methods. The first thing he said in his book is, We can only know the age of the earth by divine revelation, meaning there can be no scientific evidence about the age of the earth. But then he says, by the way, I've got some, and it says it's young. Now, all that I propose we do is to look at that evidence as critically as we can. Slide 69, please. There you go. Okay. The Earth's magnetic field decays. I assume he took his best shot. I assume he named the best method for getting a young age for the Earth. The Earth's magnetic field has been measured for the last 140 years. That's true. During that time, it has shown a decay. The decay is exponential. The Earth's magnetic field decays right now with a half-life of 1,400 years. And therefore, that suggests that 1,400 years ago is twice as strong, 2,800 years ago four times as strong, and so forth and so on. That's true. That's a fact. Therefore, that's a proof that the Earth is 10,000 years old. And the reason for that, Dr. Morris might say, if he had sufficient time, I'll make the argument for him, give him a break, is that at 10,000 years ago, the field would have had to be so strong that we'd all be pointing towards the North Pole. It's absolutely true. It'd be unimaginably strong. So why is it that he chooses to make this argument in front of a general audience instead of a bunch of geologists to educate them? And the reason is because the geologists would laugh him out of the room. This is a slide showing the magnetic field that is captured in the mid-Atlantic ridge where the Earth's crust comes up from the core and spreads. Now, when certain kinds of minerals cool and crystallize, those minerals preserve in their molecular structure a little compass pointing towards the magnetic pole. That's established. That's a fact. And what one discovers when one looks at the Earth's floor is that in different ages, as the floor has spread, all of a sudden the North Pole and the South Pole have reversed. I think in this slide, the normally magnetized lava is shown in black, and the abnormally, the ones that are pointing to the South Pole, which is actually the North Pole and so forth and so on, are shown in white. In other words, the Earth's magnetic field has gotten stronger and weaker and stronger and weaker and stronger and weaker and reversed and gone back and reversed and gone back again and again through history. The next slide shows that if you drill down into the ocean core, that's exactly what you find. Now, the rates of sedimentation are in different oceans, but the pattern of reversals is consistent. The next slide shows the number of reversals that we have documented for the recent past. And as you can see, there are enormous numbers of magnetic field reversals. The reason we don't use this uncritical characteristic to measure the age of the Earth is because it's wrong. In fact, it turns out to be a proof. Now, it's not wrong. It's not wrong because it contradicts evolution. It's wrong because we can see that the Earth's magnetic field has reversed hundreds of times in the previous past. In fact, if you calculate the rate of reversal we see right now and realize that it's occurred this many times, it turns out to be a proof for the old age for the Earth. It's remarkable. Next slide. Now, there are other sorts of things that many of you may be familiar with, and Dr. Morris didn't have time to bring up. I'm cruising along okay, so I'll make an argument for him. There's an old article the creationists like to quote that says that cosmic dust accumulating on the Earth should have formed in 5 billion years an enormous layer of dust. It should be 60 feet thick, and it's not here. I heard this argument made on television by a preacher in an argument with Carl Sagan. It's a very, very interesting argument. The article they quote, and this is indicative of the creationist philosophy, and this is one of the methods in Dr. Morris's list. The article they quote is a Scientific American article from 1959 by Hans Pedersen. And Pedersen came out with a figure of 5 million tons of dust per year. He climbed up on some high mountains in Hawaii where there were no factories around spewing metal particles into the atmosphere and tried to measure the distinctive metals that come down in meteorites. This is the figure he got. The numbers about 20 or 60 or 80 feet thick are absolutely true. The creationist says, we didn't find that much dust on the moon. Therefore, the universe must be recent. Well, it's interesting to me that the creationists, when they do it, will quote this article, 20 years old. Now, the reason for that is because when we go into space and put satellites up, one of the first things NASA did was to try to measure the rate of meteorite dust accumulation. The next slide. And the reason Pedersen stopped doing the work was because he was a Swede and he couldn't put an experiment on the American satellites. And what we discovered in space is that the rate of dust accumulation is, in fact, much, much less. It turns out to be 10 to the minus 16th to 10 to the minus 17th gram per square centimeter per second. That's actually a lot of dust. And if you multiply that times the estimated age for the universe, you come up with an accumulation of dust in the range somewhere between a centimeter and a half and 15 centimeters. That's about 6 inches. Okay, we went to the moon a few years ago. Next slide. What did we find on the moon? We found the right amount of dust. The surface of the moon is covered by a material known as the regolith. The regolith is a debris blanket of pulverized lunar surface. And what we discover on the surface of the moon is, in fact, that the right amount of dust is there. About 1% of the 10-meter-thick regolith is meteorite dust. 1% of 10 meters is 10 centimeters right in the middle of the range. When you examine any of the processes that Dr. Morris uncritically brings up and says, but I've got evidence for a young age, the magnetic field reversal, the meteoric dust, or anything else, they turn out to be arguments for old age. Rest my case. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're now going to begin a question period, and the speakers will be asked to speak briefly in reply to questions which some of you submitted during the intermission. It's unfortunate that all the questions submitted could not be used, but unless this is to go on till 3 o'clock in the morning, a selection had to be made, and a selection has been made of 4 questions for Dr. Morris and 4 for Dr. Miller. The first one, which I'll read out, is addressed to Dr. Morris. If we are to accept that the Creator spoke the universe into existence with photons, conveniently placed so as to make stars look billions of light years away, could we not equally accept that the universe was created a millisecond ago with prepackaged memories of your 2.5-hour debate implanted in our minds? If the Creator can do anything, can't we accept anything?
This device of trying to defeat an argument by ridicule rather than by serious consideration, of course, has been used many times in the past. And obviously, when you suggest the Creator could create things with an appearance of built-in memories, yes, in principle, of course, as the Creator, he could do that. And if there is a Creator, then you can't say no. But on the other hand, that would raise a question of purpose and deception. But when we suggest that there is creation, then the only way to say that there is no possibility of creation with an appearance of maturity or completeness or appearance of age or whatever is to say that creation is impossible. And that's to say that there's no creator, which is tantamount to atheism. You finally have to take your choice. It is reasonable that the Creator, if the Creator exists, would create things fully functioning right from the beginning. Now, I did mention that there are other possibilities with respect to the matter of the light and the apparent creation of the light energy along with the generators of the light energy. There's the possibility of Riemannian space, which Dr. Moon and Dr. Spencer have elaborated in considerable detail. Dr. Slusher then has picked it up in his book, The Age of the Cosmos, and has shown that it is possible if you use a different form of space geometry than Einsteinian geometry, that even though you use Euclidean space, light will travel in Riemannian space, and it works out, the mathematical equations work out, that light would reach the Earth from an infinite distance in 15.7 years. Now, I don't understand that, but these astrophysicists at MIT worked it out, and that's what their equations give. There's also the possibility that the Creator created the universe fully functioning. And from the point of view of a creationist, if you want to ridicule that belief, all right, I see nothing ridiculous about it.
On to the suggestion about Riemannian space. I have learned a little bit about Riemannian geometry, and of course I've got a D to show for it. And essentially what it involves is that there is a theoretical way to organize space called Riemannian geometry in which the light from a distant star, if you set up this particular kind of theoretical geometry, could be here in 15 light years. The next question is Riemannian space used to describe the universe? The answer is no. It's strictly an imaginary system. There's some very interesting papers about it. It's not used because it doesn't conform to the observed universe. Dr. Morris is attempting, as he often does, when he's short on the facts, to sow a little confusion to say, well, maybe the light got here in 15 years and so forth. Doesn't cut it. It's not true. Theoretical description. And the scientists who wrote the papers he quotes say, this is in a universe we imagine. It doesn't correspond to the real one.
Question for Dr. Miller. How do you explain the footprints in stone phenomenon? In Texas, single strata of rock were found to contain 23 footprints in line that were crossing lines of brontosaurus tracks. This contradicts the geological timetable. Tracks are thought to be separated from each other by 60 to 70 million years or so.
Carousel number 2, slide 10. Could you cut the big lights in front? I think we can leave the overhead ones on. Maybe not, though. Is it up there? Is this too bright? There we go. Okay, I wasn't sure Dr. Morrison would bring a slide, so I brought my own.
There they are.
Those are the, if we turn this one light off, we'd actually be able to see it. Those are the contemporaneous footprints of man and dinosaur. That's great. Now, here's how I explain it, in all honesty, and I'm not trying to be a wise guy. I believe, quite simply, that the people who present these as evidence have learned a lesson from a hoax perpetrated in the human anthropological literature known as Piltdown Man. Piltdown Man was a fossil that somebody planted and some poor other sucker dug up and put in the human evolutionary sequence and named and so forth and so on. And when those nasty people with radiometric dating came along in the 1950s, they made them drag the skull and the jaw out of the museum and they dated them. And what they discovered was that the jaw dated to the present time, and the skull was 15 or 20,000 years old. The reason for that is because the skull was the skull of a Homo sapiens sapiens, and the jaw was the jaw of a chimpanzee, and they'd been set up as a hoax. What the footprints show is that the special creationists have learned a lesson from Piltdown Man, and the lesson is, if you bring in a bone, they'll date it. Give them a footprint. One other point I want to make. For some reason, the only footprints that show up here are humans. Now, if the special creations are right, we ought to have a few dog tracks, a few cat tracks, a few deer tracks. For some reason, only humans. And the answer is, a carving of a human footprint would have the greatest psychological effect. I believe I did. The question is, how do you... Excuse me. I believe I did. The question was, how do you explain them? I say they're fakes.
The footprints were not a hoax. They're there. I've seen them. You can put your foot in them. Some of them are giant-sized tracks. Some of them are baby-sized tracks. Some of them are normal-sized tracks. They'll fit your foot just as good as a house shoe. These were not carvings. I mentioned that before. There was a trail leading under the riverbank, so a bulldozer was brought in to turn out the overlying strata under the bank to see if the trails were still there. And sure enough, they were. And this was... thoroughly explored and documented. Now, we don't know for sure who made the tracks because we didn't see them made. It might have been a two-legged dinosaur with feet like human feet, as the one man said. But they were feet like human feet, and there are real tracks. Now, this is documented quite a bit more in a recent book that we have just published called Tracking Those Incredible Dinosaur and the People Who Knew Them. And there are about 200 photographs in the book. It's written from a geological point of view. My son is the author. He's PhD in geological engineering. He's on the faculty at the University of Oklahoma in this field, and he spent many, many weeks down there measuring and documenting all of this information. It does look like there is good evidence, not only in terms of the footprints, but the pictographs, stories of dragons and so forth, that man and the dinosaur did live at the same time.
Second question for Dr. Morris. How do you reconcile the reproduction of multicellular organisms from zygote to adult, or the development of a seed into a plant, with the second law of thermodynamics? Development of any living creature into an adult organism implies an increase in order and therefore a decrease in entropy.
Okay, that's a good question. I'm sorry I didn't have time to get into it before, and I'm not sure I really have adequate time now. No creationist that I know of has ever said that it's impossible to have an increase in order in an open system. We insist that you can have an increase in order in an open system. We also point out that the second law of thermodynamics, which is a very broad principle, doesn't apply strictly to heat flow equations or to chemical process rate equations. It's a universal principle, as the references given earlier indicate. The second law of thermodynamics says that in any system, there is a tendency for that system to go from order to disorder, or from complexity to simplicity. And everybody knows that. Everybody experiences that. You just let things go, they go down. They wear out, they disintegrate, they die finally. This is universal experience. There's a tendency in even open systems for this to happen. But in an open system, open to external energy, you can, under certain conditions, neutralize that decay effect or even reverse it and have an increase of order. And a classic example would be the growth of a seed into a plant, or a zygote into a fully developed animal, or a pile of bricks into a building. you can have an increased order in an open system, obviously. Now, just to say that you can have it doesn't mean that you usually have it. Matter of fact, every system is an open system. A closed system only exists in the ideal world of a blackboard where you can draw a circle. In the real world, every system is an open system. And furthermore, every system is open to the energy of the sun, either directly or indirectly, as far as the Earth is concerned. All systems get their energy ultimately from the sun. That means that to say that a system is open to the energy of the sun is to say nothing that isn't true of everything. So that's meaningless as far as a particular reply to this problem is concerned. And when we say that there's a conflict between the second law of thermodynamics and evolution, for evolutionists to say, well, the second law of thermodynamics only applies to closed systems and the Earth is an open system, open to the energy of the sun, is really not a meaningful statement, because that statement applies to every system, and most systems decrease in order. Now, the point is, what do you have in a system like a seed going into a plant or a pile of bricks going into a building? What do you have in those kinds of systems that reverse that trend, that take the raw energy which comes in and converts it into the useful work of building up the complex structure? Now, in every kind of a system where we do have an increase of order that we know anything about, if you analyze these closely, you'll find that always at least two other criteria have to be satisfied. To have an open system open to external energy is a necessary condition, but it isn't a sufficient condition. Now, in addition, you have to have a code or a program or a template or something to organize the growth, to direct the growth, like the blueprint for the building or like the genetic code for the seed, some kind of a highly complex information program already built into the system or accessible to it to direct its growth. Otherwise, if it grows at all, it'll just be a heterogeneous blob. It won't increase in order a bit. And in addition to that, you have to have some kind of a conversion mechanism, a motor, membrane, or something else to store the raw energy from the sun, which would otherwise disintegrate and break things down, and then convert it into the very specific forms of work needed to build up the complex structure. In the case of the seed, you have the marvelous mechanism of photosynthesis, which converts the sun's energy through a complex series of processes into the useful work of building up the plant tissue. In the case of the building, you have the machinery, the muscles of the workmen, and so forth, that take the sun's energy and convert it through all sorts of intermediate processes before it becomes the useful work. You see, if all you have is just raw heat energy flowing into a system, into an open system, you will not increase the order of that system at all. If you go back to your equations of thermodynamics, you know that if you have an influx of heat energy into an open system, not a closed system, but into an open system, an influx of heat energy into an open system will increase the entropy of that system more rapidly than if it were a closed system. It would break it up. It won't increase the order at all. In other words, you've got to have a mechanism to direct the growth and a conversion system, a code, I should say, to direct the growth and a conversion mechanism to energize the growth, or you won't get any growth no matter how much energy comes into the open system from the sun. Now, the question is, what does evolution have in terms of a biochemical predestinating code directing the growth of primeval chemicals into complex people over the ages? It is a continuum in a space-time frame from some simple systems back in the beginning to a very complex biosphere now. Nobody knows what that is. And what is the mechanism that converts the sun's energy into this complex work of building up the complex biosphere, converting, say, a population of worms into a population of crocodiles or something over the ages? Now, there is no answer to that yet. There have been certain people who have tried to pose answers. Dr. Miller quoted Dr. Eigen, Dr. Prigogine got a Nobel Prize for trying to get at a part of the answer, but nobody really has the answer yet. We're nowhere near explaining how evolution and entropy can really coexist on any significant scale. Now, even if such an answer is ever given, finally, if somebody can pose a code and a mechanism to explain how evolution can take place in spite of the second law of thermodynamics, it still will not be as good as the creation model. The creation model does not have to explain the second law of thermodynamics. Creation model predicts the second law of thermodynamics. It's exactly what you'd expect in the creation model.
At some point or another, you have to consider what's true. Dr. Morris said, if all you have, and Dr. Morris is a very good debater. He chooses his words carefully. He really does. He says, for example, if all you have is an influx of heat energy, underlying heat, into a system, the system will increase in disorder. That's true. If you take some molecules of water and you heat them up, the hot water is more disordered than cold water. That's true. That's the principle of thermodynamics. He chose his words carefully. He said heat. He didn't say, for example, ultraviolet radiation. Ultraviolet radiation has all sorts of bad effects on you when you're already organized. That's why we'd like to have the ozone layer up there, because we're already organized and so forth. But if you take a system like the one in Stanley Miller's flask and you shine ultraviolet light on that, what happens? One of the things that happens is that hydrogen cyanide suddenly forms adenine. Adenine is more ordered than hydrogen cyanide was. That's not supposed to happen. You're supposed to have a program. You need a blueprint. You need a code. It's false. It happens. There's something interesting about Stanley Miller's experiments. When they first did them, they had this spark. Everything ran. And the creationists said, why'd you use a spark? There probably wasn't any lightning on the primitive Earth. Well, there might have been. But the reason Stanley Miller used a spark was because first he set up his apparatus, and he took an ultraviolet light, and he shined it on the flask, and he put a special quartz window on it, because UV light doesn't pass through glass well, to allow the radiation to come inside. He had to abandon the approach. The reason he had to abandon it is because these simple, disordered, unstructured molecules, when the ultraviolet light hit them, organized into complex, intricate, organized structures so quickly they gummed up the window in the flask. At some point, you have to consider what's true. You put energy of a certain kind into a system, you will get an increase in order. You'll get it without a program.
Second question for Dr. Miller. How could the universe, as a closed system with no energy available but what it originated with out of the Big Bang, evolve from a disordered state to an ordered state?
Thank you. That's an interesting question. The question contains a self-contradiction. No serious scientist who studies the Big Bang cosmology insists for a moment that the universe was more ordered 15 billion years ago that the universe was disordered and then suddenly became orderly. Our solar system did not suddenly come from a random mixture of hydrogen, helium, and condense into order. That's not true. Big Bang cosmology says precisely the opposite. The Big Bang says that the most ordered state that ever existed was that Big Bang. Now, there's a marvelous book by a Nobel laureate at Harvard named Stanley Weinberg called The First 3 Minutes, trying to postulate what could have happened. And the fact of the matter is that nobody says what the question implies. The universe is running downhill. It's running downhill now. And the only reason that we see an increase in order, which is life on this planet, is because the universe is going downhill at a tremendous rate. And we see that process of going downhill every morning when the sun comes up, because that loss of energy from the sun is what drives things here. The universe as a whole is going downhill. We didn't get ordered out of disorderliness. The universe was the most ordered at the point of the Big Bang. That's precisely the point of Big Bang cosmology. The question doesn't understand.
I'm afraid there's a great deal of misunderstanding about the reversal of entropy that would be necessary in the first few minutes of the Big Bang to produce this order from which it's been running down. Let me just indicate this by one quote from Dr. Paul Davies of the King's College in London, a prominent British astronomer. The title is Universe in Reverse, Can Time Run Backwards? He says there's good evidence that the primeval universe was not ordered, but highly chaotic. A relic of the primordial chaos survives in the curious radiation from space, believed to be the last fading remnant of the primeval heat. And the characteristics of its spectrum reveal that in the earliest moments of the universe, the cosmological material was completely unstructured. Now, he says, to discover the cosmic winding mechanism, one has to investigate the processes that occurred between about 1 second and 10 minutes after the bang. Unfortunately, the expansion is now too sluggish to have much invigorating effect, so the universe seems doomed to steadily unwind again until all organized activity ceases, and so on. Now, here's his conclusion. So far, it has been supposed that the shuffling process is random, but how do we know that the universe which emerged from the Big Bang was truly chaotic, so that subsequent collisions between atoms and interactions between subatomic particles are overwhelmingly likely to disintegrate any order which may appear? If the miracle of the Big Bang, and note he uses the word miracle, you have to go against the second law of thermodynamics to do it, included miraculously organized subatomic arrangements too, then random shuffling would have to be replaced by organized rearrangement. And so you have to postulate an exception to the second law of thermodynamics to make the Big Bang function in the first few minutes.
To Two questions remain for each speaker. I've been asked by the arrangements, Chairman, to use the gavel to keep the answers and rebuttals brief. Third question addressed to Dr. Morris. You ask why we only see gaps between species and never see species in the process of splitting up. Scientists observe many examples of species that look as if they were in the process of splitting up. For example, species of birds look identical but cannot crossbreed. Other groups of birds are able to crossbreed, but only with difficulty and a very low success rate. Similarly, a horse and a donkey can crossbreed to create a mule, but the mule is sterile and cannot crossbreed further. Aren't these examples of the species giving rise to another species?
I'm not quite sure I understand the point of the question, but let me repeat what I said earlier, that we creations do not know the precise limits of variation within the created kind. We do not know whether the created kind corresponds to a modern species, as it does perhaps in many cases, or to the genus, as it does perhaps in many cases, or even to the family, as it may do in some cases. I think this is room for further creationist research, and a number of creationist geneticists are working on this at the biomolecular level to try to delineate this a little better. We would suggest that if species do produce fertile hybrids, this is probably a good indication that they represent original kinds that have become separated and more or less reproductively isolated for a while. If they produce sterile hybrids, I think the question needs further study. We do not profess to have a full answer, as I said, to what exactly constitutes the created kind. Neither, of course, does the evolutionists know exactly what a species is, because they've traditionally been the lumpers and the splitters, and these are taxonomic categories that have been made ever since the days of Linnaeus for man's convenience, and they're somewhat arbitrary. They're subject to change with further research.
Dr. Miller chooses not to comment on that reply. We'll instead take the third question, which is addressed to him. Dr. Miller stated that he could possibly enter the universe, a closed system, from surroundings. Now, the existence of surroundings is purely presuppositional in nature. That is, it is not based on empiricism or rationalism. The existence of surroundings is clearly beyond the scope of finite man. Presuppositions are all right as long as you don't use them as a base for other assumptions. Dr. Miller, please support the concept of a surrounding system for the universe.
I'm not aware I ever said anything like that. I believe what I said is that the Earth has surroundings and energy can enter the Earth. I have no support for such a concept. I don't believe I ever said anything, and I'm not sure that anyone actually does. Now, there is an interesting thing that I think this question is trying to bring up, and I think this person is perhaps trying to force me into saying that the thermodynamics, because the universe has been running down, implies that there was something to wind it up in the first place, and therefore it implies that there was a creation, because the creator had to provide the energy in the system, had to provide the high degree of order that existed at the creation of the universe. Well, the difficulties that science has with that are very great. My own personal reaction to it is very simple. I agree. I think that is evidence for creation. I think that's one of the reasons for believing that there is a creator. The question is not between Dr. Morris and me whether or not there's a creator. I think the universe was created. I think that's why there's here, why we're here. I subscribe to the point of view, not as a scientist, but as a person trying to make sense out of the world I see around me in a theological way. I subscribe to the point that Hans Küng makes in Arguments Against the Atheist. And one of those points is, if there is no God, why is there something instead of nothing? So I believe I agree with the questioner. Thanks.
Dr. Miller wishes to take his fourth and final question at once. Dr. Morris, you mentioned that the Earth's strata were formed by a catastrophic flood, and that creatures we now see as highly evolved ran from the flood to higher levels. Highly evolved plants are found only in higher geologic strata. In lower geologic levels, you see only lower plants. Could you please explain how these highly evolved plants ran from the flood catastrophe?
The question posed here question. Will those characters sort of work at me? Does have a point? Does the point? We're going to say this.
Last question. And I think you can see, and from the responses and reactions and rebuttals and so forth, that there's much to be said on both sides. Dr. Miller probably doesn't agree with my answers. I certainly don't agree with his. The arguments and discussions could go on for a long time. He refuted or attempted to refute Dr. Barnes's magnetic field decay problem. Of course, I realized when I put those dates on the screen that he had asked me to do that, and therefore he was sort of laying for me, but that was all right. But don't think that Dr. Barnes hasn't anticipated this question of the reversal of the magnetic field. He has. This is discussed at great length and answered it, I think, with overwhelming cogency, and the problem still does exist. The evidence for the magnetic field decay does still stand. Now, with respect to the origin of the strata in the flood, I did not suggest that animals ran from lower levels to higher levels. I said that the basic order that one would predict in a worldwide hydraulic cataclysm would be an order of ecological zonation. That is, those animals that live at the lower elevations would, other things being equal, tend to be buried at the lowest elevations. That is, the simple marine organisms which live at the depths of the ocean would tend to be buried at the bottom. The less mobile marine invertebrates would tend to be buried fairly low. The free-swimming marine vertebrates, fishes and so on, would tend to be buried higher. They live at higher elevations and also would be able to escape burial more for a greater length of time. Then the animals that live at the interface between the land and the water, the amphibians, then the reptiles, then the animals that live at the upper levels, the mammals, and the higher levels, birds and man. That's a general order of ecological zonation, or elevation of habitat, if you will. That is,